welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we're going for the gold. Most of us aren't heading off to London to the Olympics, but we are channeling into the excitement via hours and hours of TV coverage. This week, we'll explore titles from the wide world of sports, great athletes of yesteryear, and those men and women who are using sport to turn their lives around. Their stories are inspirational, sometimes humorous, and always great listening. So let the games begin as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Dusty road stretches into the distance like a pencil line across the arid landscape. Lions, rhino, and buffalo roam the plains on either side. But I haven't come to Kenya to spot wildlife. I've come to run. Whether running is your recreation, your religion, or just a spectator sport, Adharunnan Finn's incredible journey to the elite training camps of Kenya will captivate you. Running with the Kenyans, passion, adventure, and the secrets of the fastest people on earth is part travelogue, part memoir, and part quest to uncover the secrets of the world's greatest runners. As a boy growing up in the English countryside, the author was a natural runner. While other kids struggled, he breezed through the schoolyard races. But as he grew, pursued a career in journalism, married and had kids, those childhood dreams slipped away until suddenly, in his mid-30s, Finn realized he might only have one chance left to see how far his talents could take him. Uprooting his family of five, Finn traveled to Iten, a small, chaotic village in Kenya's Rift Valley, a mecca for long-distance runners thanks to its high altitude, endless running paths, and some of the top training schools in the world. Finn would run side by side with Olympic champions, young hopefuls, and barefoot school children, not to mention exotic and sometimes dangerous wildlife. Along his journey, Finn met colorful characters, including his unflappable guide, Godfrey Kiprotich, a former half-marathon champ, Christopher Shebobuch, one of the fastest men ever to run the New York City Marathon, and Jafet, a poor bucktooth boy with unsuspected reservoirs of courage and raw speed. Amid the daily challenges of training and raising a family abroad, Finn learned invaluable lessons about running and about life. John Lee narrates.
We run under the goalposts and swing down close beside the stone wall along the far edge of the field. It's quieter now. I look around. One other boy is just behind me, but the others have all dropped back. Up ahead I can see the fluttering tape marking the next corner. I run on, the cold air in my lungs, the tall poplar trees shivering above my head. We go out of the school grounds, along a gravel path that is normally out of bounds. My feet crunch along, the only sound. An old man pushing a bicycle stands to one side as I go by. I follow the tape, back down a steep slope, onto the playing fields, back to the finish. I get there long before anyone else, and stand waiting in the cold as the other runners come in, collapsing one after the other across the line. I watch them, rolling on their backs, kneeling on the ground, their faces red. I feel strangely elated. It's the first P.E. class in my new school, and we've all been sent out on a cross-country run. I've never tried running farther than the length of a football field before, so I'm surprised by how easy I find it. "He's not even breathing hard," the teacher says, holding me up as an example to the others. He tells me to put my hands under my armpits to keep them warm, as the other children continue to trail in. A few years later, at age 12, I break the 800-meter school record on sports day, despite a few of the other boys attempting to bundle me over at the start in an effort to help their friend win. 5 minutes later, I run the 1,500 meters and win that, too. When we get home, my dad, sensing some potential talent, suggests that I join the local running club and looks up the number in the telephone directory. I hear him talking to someone on the phone, asking directions. From that point on, a course is set. I am to be a runner. It all begins rather inauspiciously, one night, a few weeks later. I put on my shorts and tracksuit and walk across the bridge to the shopping mall next to our suburban housing estate in Northampton, England, a town of 200,000 people, 65 miles north of London. The precinct is half deserted, save for a few late shoppers coming out of the giant Tesco supermarket. I head down the escalator to the car park, and then across the road to the unmarked dirt track, where the Northampton Phoenix Running Club meets. It's a cold night, and all the runners are crammed into a small doorway in the side of a huge red brick wall. Inside, the corridor walls are painted blood red and covered in lewd graffiti. Down the hall are the changing rooms, where men can be heard laughing loudly above the fizz of the showers. I give my name to a lady sitting at a small table. Rather than head out onto the track, as I had imagined, I'm taken back across the road with a group of children my age, to the shopping mall's delivery area, a stretch of covered road with shuttered loading bays all along one side. The road itself is thick with discharged oil. A man in tights and a yellow running jacket gets us to run from one side of the road to the other, touching the curb each time. Between each sprint, he makes us do exercises such as push-ups or jumping jacks. I begin thinking, as I lie back on the cold, hard concrete, ready to do some sit-ups, that I've come to the wrong place. This isn't running. I had imagined groups of lithe athletes hurtling around a track. My dad must have gotten confused and called the wrong club. I'm so convinced this isn't the running club that I don't return for another year. When I do, they ask me if I'd like to train in the tunnel, which I take to mean the shopping mall loading bays, or head out for a long run. I opt for the long run and am directed over to a group of about 40 people. This is more like it. As we set off along the gravel pathways that wind around the council estates of East Northampton, I feel for the first time the sensation of running in the middle of a group of people. The easy flow of our legs moving below us, the trees, houses, lakes floating by, the people stepping aside, letting us go. Although most of the other runners are older and constantly making jokes, as I drift quietly along, I feel a vague sense of belonging.
We've just heard Running with the Kenyans by Adharanand Finn. In October 2006, the night before he turned 40, Rich Roll experienced a chilling glimpse of his future. Nearly 50 pounds overweight and unable to climb the stairs without stopping, he saw where his sedentary lifestyle was taking him. Most of us look the other way when granted such a moment of clarity, but not Rich. Plunging into a new way of eating and daily training, Rich morphed in mere months from an out-of-shape midlifer into an endurance machine. 90 days into his physical overhaul, Rich left the house for a light jog and found himself running a near marathon. It was time to scale up his goals. How many of us take up a sport at age 40 and compete for the title of the world's best within 2 years? Finding Ultra, Rejecting Middle Age, Becoming One of the World's Fittest Men, and Discovering Myself recounts Rich's remarkable journey to the starting line of the Elite Ultraman World Championship competition, a 320-mile ordeal of swimming, biking, and running. Following that test, Rich conquered an even greater one, the Epic 5 Challenge, 5 Ironman distance triathlons, each on a different Hawaiian island, all completed in less than a week. That's nuts! This is more than an inside look at a series of jaw-dropping athletic feats or a practical training manual. It's a testament to human resiliency. The author narrates.
Impossible, they told me. Vegans are spindly weaklings, incapable of anything more athletic than kicking a hacky sack. No proteins in plants, you'll never make it. I heard it all, but deep down, I knew I could do it. And I did, proving them wrong and defying not just middle age, but the seemingly immutable stereotypes about the physical capabilities of a person who eats nothing but plants. And now here I was again, back at it, a second time. Just one day before, I'd begun the race in great form. I completed the day one 6.2-mile swim at Keoho Bay in first place, a full 10 minutes ahead of the next competitor, clocking the 6th fastest swim split in Ultraman's 25-year history. I was off to an amazing start. In the late 1980s, I'd competed as a swimmer at Stanford, so this wasn't a huge surprise. But cycling? Different story altogether. 3 years ago, I didn't even own a bike, let alone know how to race one. And on that first day of the race, after I'd blasted out 2.5 hours in strong ocean currents, deep fatigue had set in. With saltwater-singed lungs and my throat raw from vomiting up my breakfast half a dozen times in Kailua Bay, I faced 90 miles in blistering humidity and gale-force headwinds en route to Volcanoes National Park. I did the math. It was only a matter of time before the cycling specialist would quickly make up lost time, and I'd get past on the final 20 miles of the day, a backbreaking 4,000-foot climb up to the volcano. I kept looking back, fully expecting to see the Brazilian 3-time Ultraman champ, Alexandre Ribeiro, fast on my heels, tracking me like prey. But he was nowhere to be seen. In fact, I never saw a single other competitor all day. I could hardly believe it as I rounded the final turn through the finish line chute, my wife Julie and stepson Tyler screaming from our crew van as I won the day one stage. Leaping from the van, Julie and Tyler ran into my arms. I buried myself in their embrace, tears pouring down my face. And even more shocking was just how long I waited for the next competitor to arrive. A full 10 minutes. I was winning Ultraman by 10 minutes. It wasn't just a dream come true. I'd made an indelible mark on the endurance sports landscape, one for the record books. And for a guy like me, a plant-eating, middle-aged dad, well, with everything I'd faced and overcome, it was nothing short of remarkable. So the morning of day two, all eyes were on me as I waited with the other athletes at the start line in Volcanoes National Park, tensed and spring-coiled in the early morning dark, cold rain falling. When the gun sounded, all the top guys leapt like jaguars, trying to establish a quick lead and form an organized front peloton. It's an understatement to say that I wasn't prepared to begin the 170-mile ride with a flat-out, gut-busting sprint. I hadn't warmed up before and was caught completely off guard by just how fast the pace would be. Accelerating downhill at a speed close to 50 miles per hour, I dug deep to hold pace and maintain a position within the lead group, but my legs quickly bloated with lactate, and I drifted off the back of the pack. For this initial 20-mile rapid descent down the volcano, the situation is what's called draft legal, meaning you can ride behind other riders and safely ensconce yourself in a wind pocket. Once enveloped in the group, you're able to ride pace at a fraction of the energy output. The last thing you want to do is get dropped, leaving you to fend for yourself. A lone wolf, struggling against the wind on nothing but your own energy. But that's exactly what I'd become. I was behind the lead pack, yet far ahead of the next chase group, only I felt less like a wolf than a skinny rat. A wet, cold skinny rat, irritated and mad at myself for my bad start, already winded and staring at 8 hard hours of riding ahead. The rain made everything worse, plus the fact that I'd forgotten covers for my shoes, so my feet were soaked and frozen numb. Not a lot bothers me, including pain, but wet, cold feet make me crazy.
That was Finding Ultra by Richard Roll. The Book Report, your source for titles worthy of your time, will now introduce you to the story of Gino Bartali, an Italian cycling legend. Gino not only won the Tour de France twice, but also holds the record for the longest time span between victories. During the 10 years that separated his hard-won triumphs, his actions, both on and off the course, ensured him a permanent place in sport history. Road to Valor, a true story of World War II Italy, the Nazis, and the cyclist who inspired a nation, by Ali and Andres McConnon, follows Bartali's journey, starting in rural Tuscany, where a scrawny, impoverished boy painstakingly saves money to buy a bicycle. Before long, he is racking up cycling wins throughout the country. At age 24, he stuns the world by winning the Tour de France. But Mussolini's fascists try to hijack his victory for propaganda purposes, derailing Bartali's career. As the Nazis occupy Italy, Bartali undertakes secret and dangerous activities. He shelters a family of Jews and begins smuggling counterfeit identity documents past fascist and Nazi checkpoints by hiding them in his bicycle. After the grueling wartime years, Bartali fights to rebuild his career as Italy emerges from the rubble. In 1948, despite numerous setbacks and a legendary snowstorm in the Alps, the chain-smoking, Chianti-loving 34-year-old underdog comes back to win. Bartali's inspiring performance helps unite his fractured, war-torn homeland. Based on nearly 10 years of research in Italy, France, and Israel, including interviews with Bartali's family, former teammates, and Holocaust survivors, Road to Valor is an epic tale of courage, comeback, and redemption. Stephen Hoyan narrates.
In the 1930s, the French press was even less subtle and described this kind of racing as a tombeau ouvert, or open grave. It was hardly a figurative turn of phrase. On a similarly steep descent 3 years earlier, the Tour had experienced its first racing fatality when a Spanish rider crashed and died. The mixture of spectacle and danger has an eternal appeal, and so on July 14, 1938, the crowds came early, and they came in record numbers. Buses, cars, and other vehicles stretched for miles up and down the mountains. Many had come from the surrounding areas and nearby cities, but a good number had come from as far away as Paris on a special overnight train arranged for fans to see the stage. One journalist estimated there were up to 50,000 people gathered in the mountains. "It's unimaginable," he wrote, "to see so many fans setting up camp in the barren landscape." When the racers first set out that morning, Gino rode along with the peloton, his blue jersey lost in the sea of national colors. In time, a series of clouds lifted, and the sun bore down on them, promising a sweltering day of racing. "This stage is one of the worst one could imagine," said Gino. "It is also, in my opinion, the most punishing, because it's the first confrontation with the mountains. They arrive just like that. Without any transition, one must climb." With the gradient of the road increased significantly near the mountain town of Gourette, Gino surprised his fellow riders. Suddenly, from the small group at the lead, "one could see the blue silhouette of Bartali take off magnificently," wrote one journalist. "It was better than a sprint. It was a type of superhuman flight up the terrifying slope." No other racer chased after him, each man consumed by his own climb. Only a tour organizer's car followed closely behind Gino. It displayed a large banner that admonished, "Do not push," a warning to the drunken spectators who frequently ran onto the road to push straggling racers up the mountains. For the crowd watching and the caravan following slightly behind him, it certainly appeared as if Chino would need no such help. His pace up the slope was relentless. One had the impression, explained one reporter, that Chino was launched by an invisible catapult. Chino was alone when he reached the top of the day's first four calls, the Obisque. He rode less aggressively on the way down the other side of the mountain and lost ground. His two chief Belgian rivals chased after him and caught him. As they got up close, they scoffed at Chino's attempt to break away, chiding him for using the wrong gear. It had been so easy to catch him, they claimed, that they had time to pause and eat some tender little pigeons on the mountain road. Infuriated, Gino charged up to the second mountain pass, the Tourmalet, determined to shake his rivals. When he was about 1 mile from the top, he tried to push harder. He succeeded in dropping one Belgian rider, but he couldn't shake the other. "Am I not going to be able to get rid of this leech?" Gino asked himself. "I push, he rests. At 900 meters from the top, he is still there. I take off sprinting." Gino finally shook him off and raced into the descent. The battle up the day's third peak was waged against his own body. Chino stared down the cold face of the mountain ahead of him. He attacked once more, only to be blindsided by fiery pain. I felt my heart, usually so calm, beating hard, and it seemed, looking at my jersey, to have enlarged. My chest was so swollen and my breathing so labored, I felt something inside me tearing. I was overcome by a great fear that I would have to dismount. Nevertheless, Gino kept pushing, trying to maintain his lead. As the climb continued, he felt his mind breaking down, and the battle of voices raging in his head erupted. He began speaking aloud in delirium to the mountain. Like a chant, he started whispering, "I can't go on, I can't go on, I can't go on." Then he focused back on the mountains ahead and called them out for what they were, difficult, mean, and made of rock. His chant slowly became a series of prayers that matched the rhythm of his pedaling. Go, go, go. Then he added other words to shore up his courage, repeating them as he worked his way along the switchbacks. Up there, it's finished. Up there. The race seemed endless. The chaotic gathering of people, trucks, and cars on the mountain roadside resembled a colorful oasis in the desolate landscape well above the tree line. A few braver souls had pitched tents among the bare rocks. Others enjoyed picnics near parked publicity trucks for companies like Mon Plaisir Beer. Closer to the road, fans were everywhere, cheering from the roadside or the hoods of cars. This human mirage would disappear as soon as the racers had passed.
That was a sampling of Road to Valor by Eileen McConnon and Andres McConnon. And speaking of going for the gold, my guest today, Donna Seaman, will fill us in on a new literary award, the Andrew Carnegie Medals for Excellence in Fiction and Nonfiction. Donna writes about books, and she's quite passionate about them. She's an associate editor at Booklist, published in Chicago by the American Library Association. She also reviews books for the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, the Kansas City Star, and Book Forum. She's a book critic for Chicago Public Radio, and she interviews writers and blogs for openbooksradio.org. Donna is the recipient of many prestigious awards, including the James Friend Memorial Award for Literary Criticism and the Writer Magazine Writers Who Make a Difference Award, to list but a few. Welcome, Donna. Thanks so much for joining the Book Report today.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
Well, tell us about the Andrew Carnegie Medals for Excellence in Fiction and Nonfiction. When and why were they established?
Well, they were established very quickly this year after long discussions about how to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Andrew Carnegie Foundation. Now, many of your listeners will recognize the Carnegie name as associated with public libraries. These public libraries are actually all over the world, and they really helped boost reading and gave so many people a place to continue their education throughout their life. So what better way to celebrate than a new award for great books for adult readers. You know, we've had the Newbery and the Caldecott Awards for children's books for decades. Adult books have the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award, but they've not had an award from the kind of experts that the American Library Association and the Carnegie Foundation have. So these were established this year to celebrate the tradition of public libraries and librarians working with the public to recommend great books.
And tell us the winners for this year, the first inaugural awards.
Oh, we're so proud of these awards. And I have to say that we went through many terrific books. We love all our finalists. There were 3 finalists in each category. And the winners in nonfiction was a biography, Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Woman by the great biographer Robert K. Massey. A beautiful book, reads like a novel. Our fiction winner is The Forgotten Waltz by Anne Enright, a crisp, precise, fascinating novel, Portrait of a Woman, also, if you want to look at it that way.
And the runners-up were?
The runners-up in nonfiction were 2 just tremendously insightful and, you know, kind of recalibrating looks at the past. Another great biography, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by Manning Marable. And The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood by James Glick. That is such an exciting book. It might not sound like it with the word information, but it's very dramatic. And our fiction finalists, great novels by Russell Banks, Lost Memory of Skin, a really powerful, adventurous novel full of surprises and characters you will be surprised how much you care about. And Karen Russell's Swamplandia, an astonishingly accomplished first novel, a wild tale of the Everglades and a family in distress and an adventurous young woman.
I'm very proud to tell you that the Book Report has hosted both Russell Banks and Karen Russell on the show. And actually, both books take place in South Florida, where we're based.
That's right.
Yeah.
We had to laugh about that. They each also have reptiles on their covers, an iguana and an alligator.
Yeah, I mean, Karen Russell was also in contention for the Pulitzer Prize, which was not awarded this year.
Alas, but yes, that book's gotten a lot of attention, as it should. She's a remarkable writer.
Yeah, one of my favorites of the year, actually.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
All right, so tell me about the selection process. Who comprised the panel? How many people? What was the process like?
Well, the process was very exciting to us because the committee that was finally formed after much discussion and heaps of books and long lists based on 2 groups associated with the American Library Association, the RUSA, which works with public libraries. It's a readers advisory group, and they do a list every year called Notable Books, which is a great, rich list of books that librarians consult to work with their patrons and book groups. And then myself and 2 others are editors at Booklist, which is the venerable review magazine over a century old published by the American Library Association. And we have an editor's choice list each year published in our January issue. So between Notable Books from RUSA and Booklist's editor's choice, we had a big sea of books to look at. And that's when we started moving towards our finalists, reading all those books, discussing all those books. And our committee chair is Nancy Pearl, a librarian, a former Booklist contributor, an NPR book maven, kind of the nation's librarian. And so there were 7 of us. And we deliberated, you know, throughout the spring, working hard towards the American Library annual conference that was in late June, where we announced the winners. The finalists were announced in May.
And where can our listeners go online to get both the shortlist and the RUSA list you referred to?
You can go to ala.org and look for awards. You can also go to booklistonline.org. and search for these books. And there's lots of press releases, too, on the ALA site that profile the writers. And Booklist Online also has good long interviews with Anne Enright and Robert Massey.
Now, tell us a minute about the American Library Association for our listeners who might not realize. Is every librarian in the United States a member?
Oh, well, we wish they were. Many, many are. It is the membership organization for the profession, and this includes librarians that work with all kinds of people, from little children to university scholars, and it's a great association based in Chicago. It's been around for a long time, started in the 1800s by John Dewey, and it's been an advocacy group very famous for its Office of Intellectual Freedom, where we, as a profession and group, you know, fight for freedom of access to books, freedom to read, freedom of expression. And they're the ones that publish the banned book list each year to let people know what books are being considered controversial. And this raises many issues about freedom in our democracy. And it's also, you know, a great advocate for reading and lifelong learning and sharing. You know, that's the great thing about the librarian profession, is making everything available to everyone. It's really so important to this country.
Is there still a banned book list in 2012?
Absolutely. Every year, if you go to the ALA.org website and look up banned books, you will be shocked.
I bet I will.
It goes on at school libraries, you know, elementary school, high school. Even colleges, we have fights over books, and public libraries, too, where people from the community come in and want books yanked off the shelf.
How can a reader kind of join the fight to you know, stop this?
Well, that's a great question. Support your public library. You know, find, if you ever come across any instances where books are being banned in any form, contact the American Library Association's Office of Intellectual Freedom. We collect all these stories and respond to them.
Wow, this is a...
Read.
Well, I'm in favor of that. So has the panel started working for next year's award?
Well, we have. We're already feeling sort of overwhelmed by all the wonderful books that we're reading. You know, Booklist, we're reviewing all the time, and the Reference and User Services Association, RUSA, they're always reading for the Notable Books Group. So we are now starting to try and get a little more organized about it. But yes, we are looking ahead. We're so excited about this award. It's such a positive addition to our work.
Yeah.
And to all readers.
Tell us again where online listeners can find out more information.
Visit Booklist at Booklist Online, and the American Library Association website, ALA.org. If you plug in Carnegie Medals or Booklist, you'll find all kinds of interviews and lots of background information.
Donna, this is amazing information for readers everywhere, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much, Elaine. Thank you for your interest, and thank you for your website.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Millions of American baseball fans know with absolute certainty that umpires are simply overpaid galoots who do an easy job badly. As a kid sitting near first base at Pittsburgh's Forbes Field, there were many times I heard, "Kill the mom!" shouted with gleeful passion. As They See 'Em by Bruce Weber is an insider's look at the largely unknown world of professional umpires, the small group of men and occasionally women who make sure America's favorite pastime is conducted in a manner that is clean, crisp, and true. Weber, a New York Times reporter, not only interviewed dozens of professional umps, but entered their world, trained to become an umpire, and then spent a season working games from Little League to Big League spring training. As They See 'Em is Weber's entertaining account of this experience, as well as a lively exploration of what amounts to an eccentric secret society with its own customs, rituals, and colorful vocabulary. Charlie Steiner narrates.
How you can pull your mask upward and have your hat tip forward, I don't know. But it is possible I'm a witness. It wasn't until school was done and I went out on the field to work an actual game and my frustration continued that I solved the problem for good, or thought I did, by buying a hat with a narrower brim. Who knew different size baseball cap brims even existed? It turns out that an ordinary baseball cap has a brim of about 3¼ inches wide, with 8 seams sewn into it. The brim of a base umpire's cap is a little narrower, maybe 3 inches and 6 seams wide, and the brim of an ordinary plate umpire's hat, which is what we were issued in school, is narrower still, 2½ inches and 4 seams. The gradations downward continue until you get kind of a skull cap with 1½ inch brim that looks like an appetizer portion of a cantaloupe. Umpires call this version the beanie, and when you remove your mask, it makes you look like a refugee from the 19th century. But I like the eccentricity of it and bought one. Umpires, however, cannot afford eccentricity. Later, I would discover a scene in the popular film A League of Their Own, in which actor Tom Hanks, playing a manager, accosts an umpire wearing the beanie. "Did anyone ever tell you you look like a with a little hat on?" he says. But I wasn't aware of this at the time, and the first time I wore it, I noticed the teenage players giggling at me behind their hands. Whenever I made a call one of them didn't care for, he rolled his eyes and gave me a look. What a geek! Immediately after the game, I went back to the store and bought a hat with a 2-inch brim, and when I came back the next day to work a game in the same league, I held much more authority in the eyes of the players. Or so it seemed to me, which is really all that mattered. At this point, perhaps you're thinking, okay, taking the mask off, enough already. This is far too much detail about a mundane thing. And that's correct, except that the process I just described is a perfect analog of learning to be an umpire. You master the fundamentals, you cast them off when they don't serve, and in the end you accommodate yourself to the game and its participants. It turns out you're not alone out there. It only feels that way. The impetus for this book was a visit I made in January 2005 to the Jim Evans Academy of Professional Umpiring in Kissimmee, Florida, in order to write a story for the New York Times, where I work as a reporter. I thought it would be a lark, a chance to talk baseball rules and baseball trivia. I'm the kind of a baseball fan who has never gotten over his boyhood obsession, who reads the sports pages before the front page, and pores over box scores as if they were hieroglyphic finds. Not to mention a chance to wear short sleeves in midwinter. But what I found there in 3 days of observing, the whole course of instruction runs 5 weeks, was weird and intriguing, an amalgam of strict vocational schooling in subject matter as concrete as auto mechanics and behavioral instruction as delicate and interpretive as you'll find in any acting workshop. Moreover, virtually everything I saw was new to me. The experience persuaded me to write 2 more stories for the paper that year about umpiring. For one, I went on the road with a crew of AA umpires, 3 young men locked together for a season, traveling long distances in a van packed with their belongings through Texas, Missouri, Kansas, and Arkansas. For the other, I met in Major League ballparks and 4-star hotels with Bruce Fremming, then the senior umpire in the Major Leagues. I came away from these 3 stories convinced that a land of umpires exists, that it has citizens, laws, and a culture, and that it is exotic enough, both in the context of baseball and the context of, well, the known world, to warrant further exploring. Indeed, the presumption of this book is that professional umpires are an unusually isolated and circumscribed group, sort of like the inhabitants of a remote country that few people have ever visited, and that I'm the sociologist who was dispatched to send back word of what life is like there. I spent just about all of 2006 and 2007 and part of 2008 in the land of umpires, beginning when I went back to the Evans Academy and enrolled as a student in the 5-week program. From then on, I went where the tales of professional umpires took me, sort of like a ball bouncing erratically across a pebble-strewn infield. It wasn't a comprehensive investigation, but for the most part, it was a lot of fun.
That was an excerpt from As They See 'Em by Bruce Weber. Eat and Run, My Unlikely Journey to Ultramarathon Greatness by Scott Jurek with Steve Friedman is currently on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. a dominant force in the sport of ultra-running, Scott Jurek is a 7-time winner of the 100-mile Western States Endurance Run and a 2-time winner of the 135-mile Badwater Ultramarathon through Death Valley. Eden Run offers an inspirational account of Jurek's life as a runner and a vegan. Regaling listeners with jaw-dropping tales of endurance, Jurek delivers sound science and practical advice. Quincy Dunn Baker narrates.
My brain was on fire. My body was burning up. Death Valley had laid me out flat, and now it was cooking me. My crew was telling me to get up, that they knew I could go on, but I could barely hear them. I was too busy puking. Then watching the stream of liquid evaporate in the circle of light from my headlamp almost as fast as it splashed down on the steaming pavement. It was an hour before midnight, 105 incinerating, soul-sucking degrees. This was supposed to be my time. This was the point in a race where I had made a career of locating hidden reservoirs of sheer will that others didn't possess, discovering powers that propelled me to distances and speeds that others couldn't match. But tonight, roasting on the pavement, all I could summon was the memory of a television commercial I had seen as a child. First, there's an egg in someone's fingers, and a voice says, "This is your brain." Then the owner of the hand cracks the egg, and as it sizzles and crackles onto a hot skillet, the voice says, "And this is your brain on drugs." I saw that image in the scorching nighttime sky. I heard the disembodied voice. But what I thought was, this is my brain on Badwater. I had just run 70 miles through a place where others had died walking, and I had 65 more to go. I reminded myself that this was the point in a race where I was supposed to dust anyone foolish enough to have kept up with me in the first half. In fact, I had started this race intending to shatter its record, never mind worry about winning it. And now, I didn't think I could finish. There was only one answer. Get up and run. Whatever the problem in my life, the solution had always been the same. Keep going. My lungs might be screaming for oxygen. My muscles might be crying in agony. But I had always known the answer lay in my mind. Tired tendons had begged for rest in other places. My flesh had demanded relief, but I had been able to keep running because of my mind. But not now. What had gone wrong? Running is what I do. Running is what I love. Running is, to a large extent, who I am. In the sport I have chosen as avocation, career, obsession, an inuring but merciless teacher, running is how I answer any challenge. Technically speaking, I am an ultra-marathoner. So I compete in any foot race longer than the marathon distance of 26.2 miles. In point of fact, though, I have fashioned a career from running and winning races of at least 50 miles, most often 100, and every so often 135 and 150 miles. Some I have led from start to finish. In others, I have stayed comfortably back until the point when I needed to find another gear. So why was I on the side of the road vomiting, unable to go on?
We've just heard Eat and Run by Scott Jurek. Texas girl Babe Diedrichsen never tried a sport too tough and never met a hurdle too high. Despite attempts to keep women from competing, Babe achieved All-American status in basketball and won gold medals in track and field at the 1932 Olympics. Then Babe attempted to conquer golf. One of the founders of the LPGA, Babe won more consecutive tournaments than any golfer in history. Wonder Girl, The Magnificent Sport Life of Babe Diedrichsen Zacharias by Don Van Natta Jr., tells her story. including her bout with cancer at the height of her fame. A rollicking saga that stretches across the first half of the 20th century, Wonder Girl, narrated by Hilary Huber, is as fresh, heartfelt, and graceful as Babe herself.
Everyone knew she had earned a place among the biggest names in sports, right up there with Red Grange, Jim Thorpe, Bill Tilden, and Babe Ruth. But this seemed beyond her reach. Here, in the final somber weeks of the Herbert Hoover presidency, many Americans took comfort in the thought that Hoover was busy packing and would move out of the White House soon. President-elect Franklin Delano Roosevelt was assembling his cabinet and preparing for his inauguration just 5 weeks away. Many Americans doubted that FDR, or anyone else for that matter, possessed the know-how to lift the country out of a deep ditch. The Depression was going to last forever, and like a natural disaster, it discriminated against no one, handing out calamities in equal portions to street sweepers and bank executives, stockbrokers and stock buyers, dress designers and seamstresses, theater owners and theater goers. The owners of the palace were especially worried. Built just 6 years earlier to take advantage of all the shrillness of America's giddiest and gaudiest decade, with embellishments designed to evoke the royal palaces at Versailles and Fontainebleau, this monument to roaring 20s excess was now struggling for survival. Formerly, the tough-ticket showplace for headliners such as Mae West, Jimmy Durante, Sophie Tucker, and Bob Hope, the palace had been relegated to featuring also-rans performing before a valley of vacant maroon seats. It seemed that everyone in Chicago was hoarding their nickels and dimes for the city's new movie houses, or staying home to listen to Eddie Cantor and Bing Crosby on the radio. George P. Emerson, a Chicago advertising man with an eye for a good stunt, decided there was one woman who just might pump life into the palace. Mildred Ella Babe Diedrichson, a genuine American sports heroine and a vaudeville novice on stage, for 1 week only. Sure enough, around the palace that wintry day, there was reason for hope. By late morning, hundreds of people had formed a raucous three-block line stretching down Randolph Street. Rainy day nickels and dimes stashed in coffee cans and beneath mattresses were pushed through ticket windows. Every ticket was sold for the early matinee. At noon, the palace's wide doors swung open, and the boisterous crowd surged into the theater's sumptuous lobby. Ticket holders paused agape at the glittering designs leaping up the walls in gold leaf and oak. A few women stopped to touch up their hair and makeup in the oversized mirrors framed by sweeps of violet and ivory marble. After settling into their seats, audience members buzzed with anticipation. Why would Babe agree to do such a preposterous thing? Is she dead broke? Will she bomb? The prognostications were divided almost evenly along gender lines. The men guessed at the number of minutes that would elapse before Babe fell flat on her face. The women just smiled, hoping and half certain that the men would be counting until kingdom come.
That was Wonder Girl by Don Van Natta Jr. In this unflinching and inspiring autobiography, The Big Fight, My Life in and Out of the Ring by Sugar Ray Leonard with Michael Arkush, the boxing legend reveals the complex man behind the boxer. The Olympic hero, multi-championship winner, and beloved athlete waged his own personal battle with depression, rage, addiction, and greed. Coming from a tumultuous, impoverished household in a dangerous neighborhood in D.C. in the 1970s, Sugar Ray rose swiftly and skillfully through the ranks of amateur boxing and went on to win Olympic gold in 1976. With an extremely ill father and no endorsement deals, Leonard decided to go pro. The Big Fight, narrated by the author, takes listeners behind the scenes and chronicles the evolution of a champion as Leonard prepares for the greatest fights of his life against Marvin Hagler, Roberto Duran, Tommy Hearns, and Wilfred Benitez. At the same time, Leonard fearlessly reveals his own compulsions, his infidelity, alcohol, and cocaine abuse. With honesty, humor, and hard-won perspective, Leonard presents a portrait of remarkable strength, courage, and resilience, both in and out of the ring.
Howard, nowhere near the fighter I was, knocked me to the canvas in the fourth round. I got up right away, more humiliated than hurt, and summoned enough will to prevail in the ninth. But my heart was not in the fight game anymore, and if one is not committed, disaster is certain to strike. Lacking the motivation wasn't a problem against Hagler. From the moment I decided in the spring of 1986 to take him on, I was sure of one thing. I wanted to beat Marvin Hagler. The odds were heavily against me, and why wouldn't they be? Boxing was filled with proud warriors who came out of retirement only to discover that they should have stayed away forever. Their skills never the same after the long layoff. The saddest example being the legendary Joe Louis, the hero to my father and millions of African Americans, beaten eventually by a much younger Rocky Marciano in 1951. I knew I would be assuming the same risk as the others before me, and not only to my body, at stake at Caesars was something just as important, my reputation. When I first retired as a pro in 1982, I prided myself on being the rare exception in my sport, the fighter wise enough to get out before it became too late. If I was whipped by Hagler, a very real possibility, he hadn't lost in 11 years, I would join the long list of disgraced ex-champions, leaving one lasting pathetic image for the public I worked endlessly to impress. Over the previous 5 years, I spent less than 27 minutes in the ring while Hagler took on 8 opponents, 57 rounds, during the same period. While I trained more vigorously for Hagler than for any prior opponent, I sparred for well over 200 rounds. No amount of effort on the speed bag, the heavy bag, jumping rope, and running could compare to an actual fight against a man coming from the opposite corner whose prime objective is to inflict as much damage as is humanly possible. My sparring partners never let up. They had careers they were hoping to build. In training camp at Hilton Head, South Carolina, I felt in control of myself and the surroundings. There was a plan I stuck to every day. On fight night in Las Vegas, I felt in control again, but I didn't know if the plan would work. A fighter never knows till the bell rings. There was also an injury to my left eye, which had led to the initial retirement. The official diagnosis was a partially detached retina, which could have left me, if the doctors did not operate as soon as they did, blinded in that eye for life. The possibility of re-injuring the eye was on my mind during the Howard bout and in the months leading up to the encounter with Hagler. What if I'd thought about the eye again, if for only an instant, during the fight itself? Marvin Hagler was no Kevin Howard. He said if I was foolish enough to take him on, he was foolish enough to rip my eye out. He meant it. Hagler's bravado didn't frighten me, though it did get to my family, who were already alarmed enough to begin with. They never actually came out and shared their concerns for my safety, yet I saw the look in their eyes, just as I saw it among the members of my camp. They were afraid I might get seriously hurt. Nobody was more ferocious during the 1980s than Hagler. In 1981, he gave Mustafa Hamshaw such a thorough pounding that he required 55 stitches to plug the cuts in his skin.
That was The Big Fight by Sugar Ray Leonard. The vast majority of us can only dream of being an Olympic-level athlete. But we have no real idea of what that means. Here, for the first time in all its shocking, funny, and downright bizarre glory, is the truth of the Olympic experience. The Secret Olympian, the inside story of Olympic excellence by Anonymous, a former Olympian. It is an unimaginable world, the kitting out ceremony with its 70 pounds of team clothing per athlete, the pre-Olympic holding camp with its practical jokes, resentment, fighting, and freaky physiological regimes, the politicians' visits with their flirty spouses in tow, the vast range of athletes with their odd body shapes and freakish genetics, the post-competition release in the Olympic Village with all the excessive drinking, eating, partying, and sex, the hysteria of homecoming celebrations, and then the come down that follows. How do you adjust to life after the games? The Secret Olympian talks to scores of Olympic athletes, past and present, from Munich 1960 right through to London 2012, including British, American, Australian, Dutch, French, Croatian, German, Canadian, and Italian competitors. Paul Thornley narrates.
My head coach is the best in the world at what he does, which is coaching, training, and selecting athletes. His charges have won gold medals at every Olympics for decades now. In my sport, he is God. And God is smiling upon me. Congratulations, he says in a voice almost as leathery as his face, the thick, gravelly accent remaining despite almost two decades in the UK. He extends a hand over the top of my racing equipment. I start shaking it, not quite believing what I suddenly realise is about to happen. You're going to the Olympics. The magic words every athlete wants to hear. The Olympics. Only for the best of the best of the best. Watched by billions. The athlete's Everest. The maker of legends. Pretty cool for a Thursday morning. And I'm doubly surprised. 2 weeks ago, we'd had the opposite conversation. God had looked stern, a more natural set of his features. Yeah, okay. So now we take the next step. And the next step was the World Championships for non-Olympic events, held alongside the Junior World Championships, a sort of special circle of hell for the Olympic also-rans. The senior athletes looking and feeling vaguely inappropriate, like they're hanging around a school's back gate. But now there's been a team reshuffle. I'm going to the Olympics. Just one downside. I'm going to have to eBay the consolation 2 week holiday to Sri Lanka. Girlfriend won't be happy. Take a breath. Ask an Olympian about how they felt the moment they knew they were going to the Olympics. And from most, you get a surprisingly subdued and downbeat answer. You might imagine it would be all leaping up and down, arms raised to the heavens, then tears of happiness and heartfelt embraces with nearest and dearest. But no. One Beijing medalist I asked about how he felt at that moment replied, "It was so unimportant that I don't remember." Another Beijing medalist and Athens veteran relived the moment he discovered he was going to the Olympics for the first time. Oh, yeah. I remember. We were all really pissed off because it had been so badly handled. It still hacks me off today. We read about our selection in a press release. It was pathetic. The truth is that most see selection or rejection coming. My own case was unusual. After months and months of selection and trials, and often several years of World Championships results, the athletes generally know who's in and who's out well before the coaches sit them down. By the time you open the letter or go into the meeting with the head coach, you know what's coming, so it's a bit of a non-event. In sprint cycling, for example, the reigning world champion and World Cup winners in disciplines like the Keirin and sprint are automatically provided a slot at the Olympics. Athletics is similar. British athletes qualify based on performances at the British trials and by reaching qualifying times set by the International Association of Athletics Federation. Nick Bell fenced the individual and team foil at two Olympics. You know from the season's results in the ranking system. You're not on tenterhooks. In all the times I went to the Olympics, I knew I would go long before the selector's phone call.
That was The Secret Olympian by Anonymous. Readers, I hope this week's show has offered some inspiration to get off the couch and get moving. I'm training for my 8th half marathon in Chicago this coming September. As I train, race walking around the neighborhood, I'm always listening to a book on my iPod. Makes the miles fly by. Check bookreportradio.com for ideas of your favorite genres. Thanks so much for listening today, and see you next week on The Book Report.